Hi, everyone. Great to have you with us on Urban Highlights Cities of the World. Today, we are strapping in for a proper deep dive into Shanghai. It's this amazing urban giant that somehow manages to be both incredibly ancient, you know, culturally deep, and also right on the cutting edge of global tech. It really is a city of stunning paradoxes. And navigating it, well, it takes a level of prep, pre-trip prep. It's unlike almost anywhere else. You shared just a fascinating stack of sources with us. I mean, everything from these quite severe warnings from official government bodies, and we'll definitely get into those, please see, to like local travel hacks, deep architectural dives, and of course, the really crucial stuff, those secret street food spots. Okay, so let's try and unpack all this. Our mission really is to synthesize this huge amount of information. Shanghai is this glittering, high-tech, global financial hub, almost entirely cashless. But that convenience, that flashy surface, it's all underpinned by a really highly regulated system. And that impacts everything, doesn't it? From your digital access right down to personal safety. We kind of need to understand the hidden context behind it all.
That's exactly right. We want you, the listener, to feel totally prepared, properly informed, you know, understanding the dynamics at play. So we'll guide you through the mandatory logistics, the really strict legal landscape, that digital ecosystem you just have to be part of, and then the reward, right? The incredible food, the unique architecture that tells Shanghai's story, past and future. So our key themes today, connectivity or maybe the lack thereof, sometimes safety, cultural nuances, and yeah, that amazing food scene.
Let's start right at the beginning then, getting into the country, making sure all those legal boxes are ticked. We're calling this section Entering the Dragon. And our sources, including that really robust guidance from the German Foreign Office, the Auswärtige is amped valid through September 2025. They make it crystal clear. Preparation is absolutely the most critical step.
Yeah. And look, for many international travelers, there's actually a pretty good starting point. For instance, German citizens currently benefit from visa-free entry until the end of December 2025. That gives you up to 30 days for tourism, business, transit, even exchange programs. So that does streamline the initial bit quite a lot.
Okay, but that ease of entry, it's immediately followed by a really strict rule about where you're staying, right? Accommodation. If you check into a big hotel, fine. They handle the registration with the authorities automatically. But here's the detail you absolutely cannot afford to miss. If you stay in private accommodation like an Airbnb or maybe with friends, there's this mandatory legal rule you have to follow.
Yes, you must personally register with the local public security bureau. Specifically, it's the Entry Exit Administration Office. And you have to do it within 24 hours of arriving. This isn't just, you know, some bureaucratic suggestion. It's a fundamental legal requirement. Our sources warn quite clearly. Failing to register can lead to hefty fines, maybe even detention, or problems getting visas in the future. The whole system relies on knowing where people are physically, and this rule ensures that.
Right. And the actual physical process of getting through the border, that's become quite detailed, too. Fingerprints, for instance.
That's right. Travelers between 14 and 70, they're mandated to submit fingerprints at the border. And on top of that, there's the possibility of immediate on-the-spot medical checks when you arrive. That could be temperature checks, maybe swabs, even blood tests, potentially.
And the consequence?
Simple. Refusal to comply with any of these checks means you're denied entry. Right there. It sets a very clear tone from the moment you step off the plane, really. This is a highly controlled border, and state authority is paramount.
And that control, it stretches deep into the legal framework that every single foreigner needs to be acutely aware of. One of the most severe warnings, and it's quite complex, relates to exit bans.
Yeah, this is probably the most sobering detail in all the sources we looked at, and it really needs careful thought. Exit bans aren't just for people involved in, like, serious criminal stuff. Foreigners living in or even just visiting China could risk having their passport taken, being stopped from leaving the country indefinitely if they get caught up in civil cases, complex business disputes, even certain financial disagreements.
Hang on, just to clarify, if you're simply, say, the legal representative of a foreign company involved in a commercial dispute, maybe a contract disagreement, you could potentially be stopped from leaving China. That seems, well, staggering. For something that's purely civil, not criminal.
It is staggering, and the ban can be applied quite quickly without a long judicial process. The duration isn't fixed either. It often lasts until whatever the underlying dispute is gets settled. That's a really crucial difference from, say, many Western legal systems where a civil issue wouldn't normally lead to such severe limits on your personal freedom. But here, the state can use exit bans as leverage, basically, to ensure compliance or settlement in a very broad range of situations. So for travelers, it means extreme caution in any commercial or legal dealings while you're there.
Okay. Moving on to the criminal code, particularly around drugs. The severity here is, well, it's shocking. Unforgiving.
They are genuinely among the world's harshest penalties. Possession of even small amounts, the sources specifically mention things like 50 grams of heroin, as an example, can lead to very long prison sentences or the death penalty. And crucially, this isn't an empty threat. The death penalty is regularly carried out, including against foreign nationals. It's a very clear statement of zero tolerance from the authorities. Travelers need to treat this with absolute seriousness.
And the power of the police also extends to what we might think of as fairly minor things.
Absolutely. Police departments have the authority to impose pretty substantial fines, up to around 5,000 RMB, which is roughly 600 euros. Or they can impose up to 15 days of what's called administrative arrest. And this happens without any prior judicial review.
Wow. No court involved initially.
Not initially for that administrative detention. It allows authorities to quickly manage public order for offenses like disturbing the peace, prostitution, and this is surprising too, drug consumption. They can actually investigate and punish drug use, even if it happened before you arrived in China. They can potentially prove it using forensic analysis, like a hair sample.
Seriously?
Yes. The system is designed for speed and state control. There's very little room to challenge it right then and there.
Okay, so given that really strict regulatory environment, let's pivot to the digital world, which is just as complex, mainly because of the Great Firewall. Navigating this seems to require serious planning before you even leave home, just to access basic stuff we take for granted.
Oh, absolutely. Google, Facebook, X, you know, Twitter, WhatsApp, all blocked. And any online activity, doesn't matter what service you're using, it's subject to monitoring and tracking under China's cybersecurity law. Which leads us to this tricky situation with VPNs.
Right. We often rely on VPNs to connect when traveling, but using a VPN to get around state censorship is actually, officially, prohibited by law in China. So it's a contradiction, isn't it? You kind of need a VPN to communicate or work effectively, but technically, using one breaks the rules.
That's precisely the gray area travelers have to navigate. The official advice notes that while, you know, criminal prosecution against foreign tourists just for using a VPN hasn't been widely documented so far, the risk is still technically there. So the practical solution, based on what experienced travelers suggest, seems to be twofold. First, if you do decide to risk using a VPN, you absolutely must download and install it before you land in China.
Because trying to download it from behind the firewall is basically impossible, right?
Exactly. Accessing the necessary app stores or websites is often blocked, so get it set up beforehand.
And the second route, the one that avoids the legal gray area.
Correct. This is often safer and more reliable. It involves using a roaming eSIM from a provider that's not based in mainland China. Think companies like Araloa or 3HK, often routing through Hong Kong. Because your data connection goes through a foreign network first, it bypasses the Great Firewall restrictions naturally. So you can access blocked sites like Google, WhatsApp, whatever, natively. No need for a technically illegal VPN connection.
That sounds like the way to go for anyone who really needs reliable access to Western apps for work or keeping in touch.
It's definitely the recommended approach for guaranteed access, yeah.
Okay, now let's talk money. Or rather, the lack of physical money. The digital integration in Shanghai seems so total that cash is almost obsolete. We hear it's nearly 100% cashless.
The shift is pretty much total. Honestly, many smaller vendors, street stalls, they simply don't have change anymore. Trying to pay with cash can be really cumbersome, sometimes just impossible. To really function smoothly in Shanghai, you absolutely have to get set up with the digital payment system. That means installing and learning either Alipay or WeChat Pay. Generally, Alipay is recommended for international visitors. Its English interface is better, and it seems to handle linking foreign cards and verification a bit more smoothly for non-Chinese users.
And the single most crucial piece of advice we got from the sources about this was the pre-arrival setup, wasn't it? You must link your international credit card and fully verify your identity on Alipay before you get to China. Why is that step so vital?
Because trying to do the identity verification or link a card once you're already in China, behind the firewall, potentially struggling with internet access, it can turn into a bureaucratic nightmare, honestly. Getting it all sorted while you still have easy, unfettered access to your home bank accounts, verification texts, all that stuff, it's really the only way to guarantee you can hit the ground running smoothly.
Makes sense. And once that's done, Alipay basically becomes your key to everything, especially transport.
It simplifies pretty much everything, yeah. Didi, which is China's version of Grab or Uber, it's handled entirely within the Alipay app. You can also generate digital metro and bus cards right in the app. For the metro, you scan your QR code twice, once when you enter, once when you exit, so it calculates the fare. For the bus, it's just one scan when you board.
And the fares are incredibly cheap, apparently.
Astonishingly cheap. Often just 2 to 4 yuan for short rides, which is, what, like 30 to 60 cents? It's a massive convenience for getting around the city.
There was a little Didi hack mentioned, too, something about verifying your phone number.
Ah, yes. That speaks volumes about the verification culture. When your Didi driver arrives, you usually need to verbally tell them the last 4 digits of the phone number you use to register the app. It's like a final security check before the ride starts, confirming you're the actual tracked user who requested the car. It's a perfect little example of how convenience and verified identity are just totally fused together in the Shanghai system.
Okay, so that's the groundwork. The stringent, sometimes maybe intimidating regulatory and digital framework. But get that right, navigate that foundation, and the reward seems immense. Let's pivot now from logistics to pure sensory indulgence. Shanghai's legendary food scene.
Right. When we talk about actual Shanghai cuisine, the local stuff, we're talking about benbang. And what's fascinating is that it's actually the youngest of China's 8 major regional kitchens. Only about 400 years old, its flavor profile is quite distinct. It's known for sweetness, often balanced with a kind of oily richness. And there's a heavy focus on what's local, freshwater fish, eels, crustaceans, lots of seafood. It's definitely less fiery than, say, Sichuan food, and generally sweeter than a lot of Cantonese dishes.
But Shanghai's street food scene just explodes way beyond benbang, doesn't it? Because the city is this huge magnet for internal migration, what, over 24 million people?
Mm-hmm.
It ends up being like a living museum of regional specialties from all over China, cooking right alongside the local Shanghai favorites. This is where those Serious Eats sources really took us on a delicious journey.
Oh, yeah. And we absolutely have to start with the dumpling power couple. First, the undisputed king, the Xiao Longbao XLB. The soup dumpling, it's just a culinary marvel, isn't it? That incredibly delicate, almost translucent skin wrapped around seasoned pork, ginger, maybe some shaoxing wine. But the magic, of course, is the soup inside.
The soup. That's the whole point. It's this gelatinized pork stock, an aspic, often made with things like pork skin or chicken bones that are high in collagen, so it sets solid when it's cold. Then when you steam the dumpling, that jelly melts into this incredibly rich, savory broth, all held inside that fragile wrapper. The eating ritual is vital too, right?
Absolutely crucial. You gently lift it with your chopsticks, place it on your ceramic spoon. Don't try and eat it straight from the steamer. Nip a tiny hole in the side to let that scalding steam escape first. Then dip it into the essential accompaniment, dark Zhejiang vinegar with some fine slivers of fresh ginger mixed in.
It's that delightful tension, isn't it? Waiting just long enough so you don't burn your mouth, but not so long that the delicate skin gives way and you lose all that precious soup.
Exactly. And then we move to the XLB's sturdier pan-fried cousin, the Shengjianbao SJB.
Ah, the SJB. These are bigger, the dough is breadier, made with yeast, and this gives you that amazing textural contrast. They cook them in these massive, shallow iron pans, first with oil, so the bottom gets really crispy and golden brown. Then they add water and slam a lid on to steam the tops until they're soft and pillowy.
So you get that soft top, super crispy, slightly oily bottom, and still inside that core of piping hot savory broth. They're definitely messier than XLB, much heartier, often served with a sprinkle of sesame seeds and chopped scallions. Delicious.
And we can't forget the simpler pleasure of Guotai, the pot sticker. Sicker skin, fried pork dumplings.
Yeah, the connoisseurs recommend eating those standing right up at the street stall. Use those narrow, almost toothpick-like disposable chopsticks they give you. You sort of spear them, navigate that crunchy fried base and the juicy pork filling. They're oily, hot, messy, and just utterly satisfying.
Okay. Moving beyond dumplings, Shanghai has these unique specialties that really define the local taste, like Shanxi Langmian eel noodles. This sounds wild.
It really is a study in contrast. You have cold, firm wheat noodles lightly dressed in sesame sauce and vinegar, but then piled on top, you get these threads of hot, sweet, sticky, intensely gingery eel, and often garnished with some crunchy, salted bamboo shoots. That mix of hot and cold, firm noodles and yielding eel, sweet and savory, it really captures the complex flavor profile of benbang cuisine. It's quite something.
And for the ultimate grab-and-go breakfast experience, the Sithan Tuan, the sticky rice ball.
Oh, this is a beast. It's basically savory textural chaos packed into a dense portable ball. It starts with a thick layer of sticky rice, Wrapped inside that, you get a whole UTL that's a savory fried breadstick, plus chopped pickles, maybe some salty, sweet, dried pork floss for texture, and often a chunk of rich, salty, preserved duck egg yolk.
Wow, that sounds like a serious carb load, designed to keep you going for hours, I guess.
Absolutely. And then there's the legendary Kong Yu Bing, the scallion pancakes. Our sources really emphasize the almost cult status these have.
Yeah, this isn't just any old pancake. The dough is apparently rolled out incredibly thinly, layered with rendered pork fat and tons of scallions to create all these flaky layers.
Yeah.
Then it's pan-fried. But the traditional crucial finishing step involves putting it inside a repurposed 44-gallon oil drum that's been turned into a charcoal oven.
Exactly. That final blast of heat in the drum oven gives it this incredible crispness all over, plus a unique smoky flavor. Apparently, the queues for the best spots can be hours long. People are serious about their Kong Yu Bing.
It's amazing how Shanghai can pivot from that intense, hyper-local street food scene straight into absolute global luxury
Right. Once
you've had your fill of dumplings and pancakes.
The high-end dining and nightlife are genuinely world-class. It's a staggering contrast.
And the luxury scene seems very much centered around the spectacle of the Bund, right? Those incredible views across the Huangpu River.
Definitely. For top-tier fine dining, you've got high-end Cantonese like Yilong Court at the Peninsula Hotel, or famous international spots like Mr. and Mrs. Bund, Hakkasan and Bund 18, Pelham's. The list goes on.
But the experiential advice, the real pro tip, seems to point towards the rooftop bar scene.
Absolutely. Places like View Bar, Flair Rooftop at the Ritz-Carlton, Sir Ellie's Terrace at the Peninsula, La Terrazza at the Bulgari Hotel. These places are essentially prime real estate because of those jaw-dropping skyline views, especially looking across to the Lujiazui Financial District lights.
And hear that great tip we found for travelers maybe watching their budget but still wanting that amazing vista? Instead of paying for an expensive observation deck ticket in one of the super tall skyscrapers, consider going to one of these rooftop bars instead.
That's smart. Often, the cover charge or the minimum spend for a drink is comparable to the price of an observation deck ticket. But you get a drink included, a much better, more relaxed atmosphere, maybe some music, and arguably better views because you're looking at the skyline, not just down from it. It's often better value and just a superior experience overall.
Good tip. And for those looking for higher energy later on.
The club scene is really dynamic. Places like Dada, Celia by Pulse, Lynx, and the very well-known Bar Rouge on the Bund, they all offer vibrant late-night dancing and attract pretty international crowds.
You know, that seamless switch from ancient street food techniques to ultra-modern rooftop bars, it perfectly captures that Shanghai paradox. And physically, the city is kind of split by the Huangpu River into these two distinct worlds, isn't it?
It really is. That river divides Puxi and Pudong. Puxi, on the west side of the river, that's the historic core. It's where you find the colonial architecture along the Bund, the charming tree-lined streets of the French Concession, and the traditional neighborhoods with their shikumen alleyway houses. Puxi really tells the story of Shanghai's complex, layered past.
And then you look across the river to Pudong on the east side, and that is just dot bam, the face of modern, hyper-capitalist China. It's the financial district. It's relatively new, built up incredibly quickly, this massive expanse of innovative, often futuristic-looking infrastructure, and of course, those record-breaking skyscrapers that define the 21st century skyline.
Pudong is definitely home to architectural extremes. The Shanghai Tower, for example, stands at 632 meters, making it the second tallest building in the world. And one detail that just screams modernity is its elevator. It holds the record for the world's fastest, apparently clocking in at 74 kilometers per hour on its way up to the observation deck at 546 meters.
Wow, 74 kilometers in an elevator. You'd feel that.
I imagine so. You've also got the Jin Mao Tower, famous for the Cloud 9 bar way up on the 87th floor, and the really iconic, almost spaceship-like Oriental Pearl TV Tower with its glass floor sections.
But the real architectural genius of Shanghai, maybe, is in how it blends the old and the new, that style they call Haipai, or Shanghai style, where heritage buildings get a new life. The 1933 Old Mill Fund sounds like an incredible example.
Oh, the 1933 Old Mill Fund is truly unique. It was originally a massive, quite brutalist concrete slaughterhouse built in the 1930s, a very complex, almost labyrinthine structure. And today it's been brilliantly repurposed into this creative hub. It's full of art galleries, little boutiques, design studios, cafes. Walking through its interlocking ramps, bridges, and stark concrete corridors gives you this incredible, almost eerie sense of history and industrial scale, but now it's filled with modern creative energy. It's a fantastic contrast.
And the Rock Bund complex near the Bund does something similar, right? integrating old colonial buildings into a sleek modern development. But if you want to really understand the traditional city fabric, you need to explore the Shikumen-style neighborhoods.
Exactly. Shikumen are these traditional stone gate houses. They usually have thick brick walls, ornate stone gateways marking the entrance to the alley, and they blend European-style terrace house layouts with traditional Chinese inner courtyards. These structures form the backbone of many older residential areas. Tianzifeng is a well-known example, though it's quite touristy now. It's this maze of narrow Shikumen lanes, but now they're crammed with tiny cafes, little art studios, souvenir shops, and bars. It's bustling, maybe a bit overwhelming, but still gives you a feel for that traditional layout.
And when the sheer scale and energy of Pudong or the crowds in Tianzifeng get a bit much, Shanghai does offer places to escape. Some necessary retreats.
Definitely. The French Concession is probably the most famous escape within the city. Those beautiful, plain tree-lined streets, the European-style architecture, the little independent boutiques. It's just perfect for a long, relaxed wander. The shade from the trees is a lifesaver in summer, too.
For a deeper historical insight, there's the Shanghai Jewish Refugees Museum. It's housed in the former Olomouci Synagogue.
Yeah, this tells a really crucial, often little-known piece of history. Shanghai's unique role during World War II as one of the very few places in the world where Jewish refugees could find sanctuary without needing a visa initially. It's an incredibly moving place to visit, really essential context for the city's past.
And if you need a proper nature break, like really get away from the concrete.
There are options. Gongqing Forest Park is quite large and good for picnics or just quiet walks. Or for a bigger escape, you could head out to Changsing Island. It's a bit further out, but offers beaches, parks, bike paths. A real change of pace from the city buzz.
Okay, and one final reminder on that sightseeing strategy we mentioned earlier.
Right. Since so much of Shanghai's visual spectacle is its skyline, which you can see for free just by walking along the Bund, maybe focus your spending more on experiences rather than just entry tickets. Prioritize that rooftop bar visit over paying to go up an observation deck. You arguably get more atmosphere and better value for your money that way.
Okay, moving from the physical city to the social space. Navigating local etiquette in Shanghai seems to require quite a bit of awareness, patience, and maybe a willingness to accept norms that can feel dramatically different from what we're used to in the West.
Absolutely. A lot of the core concepts underpinning social interaction is all about saving face, or maybe more importantly, avoiding causing someone else to lose face. This means that indirect communication and avoiding direct confrontation are really highly valued. As a traveler, you should try never to force a local acquaintance into giving you a direct, uncomfortable no. They'll likely use polite workarounds, vague language, maybe change the subject, understanding that indirectness is really key to smooth interactions.
And this extends to conversation topics too, doesn't it? There are things you just don't discuss.
Definitely. Travelers need to be strictly aware. Avoid sensitive subjects. Politics, human rights, religion. These are generally off limits in casual conversation, especially with people you don't know well. Pushing these issues will, at best, cause serious social discomfort, and at worst, could potentially lead to issues with authorities. It's just not worth it.
Conversely, though, you should be prepared for questions that might feel quite personal by Western standards.
Yes, that's a common experience. New acquaintances might ask quite directly about your relationship status, your salary, whether you're married, have kids. The intention behind this is usually meant as an icebreaker. A sign of genuine interest in getting to know you, not necessarily being nosy or intrusive. The key is to have a polite, perhaps slightly vague answer ready if you're uncomfortable, but try to recognize it as a cultural way of building rapport.
Some of the observations on public behavior quirks are particularly fascinating, often seeming like a complete flip of Western etiquette. Take spitting, for example.
Right. Our sources noted that spitting may be into a designated bin, but sometimes just discreetly on the ground, or even in odd places like airplane galleys, apparently is considered relatively common and generally acceptable. It's seen as a way to clear phlegm.
Okay. Yet, doing something we consider pretty normal, like blowing your nose into a tissue in public, that's considered quite rude.
Generally, yes. That contrast can be quite jarring for first-time visitors. Keep the nose blowing more private, if possible.
And then there are those practical, local adaptations to daily life, the famous squat.
Ah, yes, the Asian squat. Many Chinese people, especially older generations or in more informal settings, will rest or even eat street food in a deep squat position with their feet flat on the ground. It's actually a very stable and surprisingly comfortable resting position if you grew up doing it. It's often preferred over just sitting down on a curb or step.
And of course, the summer icon, the belly shirt.
The Beijing bikini, as it's sometimes humorously called, that you see in Shanghai too. When it gets really hot and humid, think 35 degrees Celsius, 99% humidity, it's very common to see men, particularly older men, roll or lift your shirts up to expose their midriffs. It's just a straightforward, practical way to catch a breeze and cool down, a perfect example of adapting to the climate. No big deal locally.
But despite all these cultural differences, maybe things that seem unusual to us, the sources consistently loop back to safety, don't they? Shanghai feels incredibly safe on the street.
It really does, and that feeling is directly linked to the very high visible police presence, the incredibly dense network of CCTV cameras everywhere, and as we discussed, that underlying digital tracking system. That pervasive surveillance, while it definitely raises privacy questions for us, undeniably contributes to a high degree of personal security day-to-day for both residents and tourists.
Okay, finally, we absolutely have to spend some time on dining etiquette, especially if you're lucky enough to be invited to a meal by a local host, because many Western norms seem to go right out the window at the Chinese dinner table.
They really do. First rule, deference to the host. If you're invited out, the host will almost always take charge of ordering everything for the table. They'll select a wide array of dishes to ensure variety, show generosity, and maintain face. You really shouldn't reach for the menu or try to order yourself unless the host specifically invites you to suggest something.
Okay, host orders. Got it. And then there are the rules or lack of rules around noise and messiness. This sounds counterintuitive.
It can feel that way. But things like slurping noodles or soup loudly, what the Germans call schmatzen, it's not just acceptable, it's often encouraged. It signals that you're really enjoying the food. Talking with your mouth full is also pretty common during lively meals. And general messiness, like spitting small bones or pieces of gristle directly onto the table beside your plate or onto a communal discard plate, is standard practice.
So the advice is basically, just follow the lead of your host and the others at the table. Don't be overly prim and proper.
Exactly. Relax, enjoy the communal atmosphere. The focus is on enjoyment and satisfaction. But the single most important rule, and it ties right back to that concept of saving face, is the and stands rest, the polite leftover.
Right. You must always leave a little bit of food on your plate at the end of the meal. Why is that so absolutely crucial?
Because culturally, eating every single last grain of rice or scrap of food implies that the host didn't provide enough food to satisfy you. It suggests they were stingy, which would cause the host to lose face significantly. Leaving that small and stands rest is the vital nonverbal signal that you were amply, generously, and satisfyingly fed. It upholds the host's honor. It's really important.
Okay, vital tip. And two quick final ones on table manners. Chopsticks.
Yes. Never, ever stick your chopsticks vertically upright into your bowl of rice. Just don't do it. It visually resembles incense sticks used in offerings for the dead at temples or funerals, so it's considered a very bad omen. Incredibly disrespectful. Always lay them flat across your bowl or on the chopstick rest.
Got it. And payment.
Splitting the bill is highly unusual, almost unheard of in traditional settings, especially if someone has clearly invited you. The host, or the person who extended the invitation, will generally insist on paying the entire bill. They might even do a sort of performative rush to the counter to pay before anyone else can get there. If you want to reciprocate, the best way is to firmly insist on paying for the next meal or outing. Trying to split the current bill can cause awkwardness. Hashtag tag outro. So to kind of wrap this all up, Shanghai, it demands really meticulous preparation, doesn't it? You have to embrace this totally cashless, highly regulated digital world before you even step on the plane. You need to be deeply aware of the serious legal risks, those potential exit bans, even from civil issues, the incredibly harsh drug laws.
Yeah, the groundwork is intense. Mm-hmm. But if you navigate that stringent structure successfully, it really does unlock this world of unparalleled convenience, efficiency, and surprisingly maybe, a high degree of personal safety on the streets. And then you're free to just immerse yourself in those magnificent contrasts, riding the world's fastest elevators 1 minute, wandering through centuries-old Shikumen alleys the next. indulging in food that ranges from those scalding, perfect soup dumplings on the street corner to incredibly refined Michelin-starred dining.
And that digital foundation of Shanghai, the need for mobile registration for everything, the use of face scans sometimes for mobile contracts, that total reliance on digital payments, that's precisely what enables the hyper-modern smoothness of it all. It absolutely delivers high convenience, but it is simultaneously a system of high surveillance and constant tracking.
And here's where it gets really interesting, I think. You have the official travel advice, which quite starkly warns you about strict controls, surveillance, the illegality of trying to bypass the firewall. Yet the actual day-to-day tourist experience once you're set up often feels incredibly smooth, convenient, efficient, and safe. That pervasive digital tracking seems inextricably interwoven with the feeling of security and ease. So the provocative thought maybe is, what does this Shanghai model mean for the future of global urban travel? Where does that line blur when digital convenience and constant surveillance become essentially two sides of the very same coin? Something pretty profound to mull over, perhaps, as you plan your own journey through this magnificent, paradoxical city.
Yeah, absolutely. We really hope you're leaving this deep dive feeling much more informed, maybe a bit more prepared, and definitely excited for your next adventure.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.